Welcome to Your Cases on Hold, a JBJS podcast hosted by Antonia Chen and Andrew Schoenfeld.
Here, we discuss the science of each issue of JBJS with an additional dose of entertainment and pop culture.
Take us with you in the gym, on the commute, or most certainly, whenever your case is on hold.
Welcome back, everyone, to Your Case is on Hold, episode 85, essentially live from Boston Logan Airport, because we are jet setters over the summer. Actually, Aunt Tony and I live a very luxurious lifestyle. We're always flying here, there, and everywhere. So sometimes you have to do the podcast live from the airport, and that's what we're doing here. This is July 1st, if you're listening. And at that moment, I would be on my way, God willing, to West Point, New York, to rendezvous with my son. And then we'll be on our way to Ohio for the 4th of July. So hopefully everyone will be listening to this over the 4th of July weekend, if not on the day we drop, or on the day that this issue of JBJS drops, July 2nd. As always, what we're covering here is the best and brightest in the journal. Our thoughts and opinions are our own, and not those of the editorial board, the editor-in-chief, the owners of the letter journals, the board of trustees, or employees of JBJS in any way, shape, or form. This episode is brought to you by JBJS CME. Definitely make sure you're checking that out and getting credit for what you're already reading, what you're already listening to, or what you're already watching. Cover all the bases on that front. As always, I am Andrew Schoenfeld, deputy editor for Methods, and my colleague across the way,
Dr. Antonia Chen, executive editor of JBJS.
So let's get into it right away here. Top of the pile, The Future of Private Equity in Orthopedics by Reddy, Strategies to Promote Health Equity for Orthopedic Surgery Patients Who Speak a Language Other than English by Buciga Torres and colleagues. What's Important, Research in Surgery, Finding Balance, and Building Community by Astor and colleagues, permanently free. A Review of Medical Ethics in Orthopedic Surgery, Current Foci and Future Considerations by Lamb and colleagues. Surgical Correction of Severe Scoliosis Leads to Changes in Central Airway Resistance, evaluated with CT-based 3D reconstruction and impulse oscillometry by Zhang and colleagues. Acute Interpositional Fat Autograft Does Not Protect Against Bar Formation and Fascia Fractures by Trepiakov and colleagues with an infographic. The Effect of Implant Constraint and Ligament Repair on Compartment Balancing After Neuroplatelar Ligament Injury in TKA by Demirlis. And now we're into the headlines, a little smaller issue than we've been seeing lately. But I think the second half of July is going to make up for that. So my article is Functional and Radiographic Outcomes of Bone Grafting for Severe Glenoid Defects in Reverse Shoulder Arthroplasty, a Minimum 5-Year Follow-Up. This is by De Silva and colleagues, and it is permanently free. So this is a study that is a single practice study. So, you know, it comes with the moniker. When you've been doing it this long, it looks like it's magic. This is all patients who underwent glenoid bone grafting for severe glenoid defects during reverse shoulder arthroplasty from 2008 to 2018, with a minimum 5-year follow-up. So they started with a candidacy of 56 shoulders, and this would be considered a great clinical retrospective of the author's experience with this technique, which they are somewhat upfront about. But they're just, you know, some interesting things I think are important to point out. They say that they had 56 shoulders initially in the 10-year time window. Of course, there may be secular trends over that time as well. 14 were not available because the patients had died, and one was excluded because of infection, which left 41 shoulders. And then of these, they had 4 shoulders in which the patients were lost to follow-up. So they say final follow-up was therefore 90%. But actually, that's only 66% because it's 37 of 56. Now, I mean, I guess you can argue a little bit about, well, you know, the 14 patients who died weren't available for follow-up, but things could have happened to them before they passed away, of course. And it's not clear from what's presented here what's available for assessment in that regard or documentation were essentially excluded. So the background in the introduction talks a lot about single center practice experience. Your kind of standard introductory rationale in this regard, this study did this with this many patients and that study did that, and these were their follow-ups and things like that. They also mentioned the work of Toshjian and colleagues. Now, that is the same senior author, and it's unclear to me how many of the patients that were included in that initial work, which is reference 10 in the paper, are also sort of included in this. But they did say in that study, they had 100% graft incorporation rate, which avid listeners to the podcast will know. I said it before, nothing is never and nothing is always. So when something has a 0% rate or 100% rate, it's just because the sample isn't large enough to allow, even when things are present, just due to chance, you're not modeling that outcome effectively. So they recognize that this is a bivariate analysis, limited in any capacity for robust translational assessment of risk factors. And that includes both selection indication and expertise bias, and then other factors that may be informal. So they do this risk factor analysis, which certainly, when I saw that, it's the brand dude paradigm when you are doing a multivariable analysis, all the less so when you're doing it with just simple bivariate comparisons. They have a lot of limitations that they note. I think they have 6 limitations, which is really highly unusual.
Cover your bases. Don't forget that.
Yeah. But at the same time, when you're presenting limitations, it's the idea of the limitation is supposed to help the reader sort of process and basically apply the work. When, as is the case here, the catalog of limitations basically runs the gamut. It becomes almost a point of, we just wanted to tell you what we did and what our experience is. Not sure if you can actually use it or apply it in your practice, or at least that's the sense that I get as I work through, the limitations. Their fourth limitation, for example, and I'm just reading for the paper, we were not able to perform a regression analysis to evaluate confounding variables because of a small data set. Unfortunately, intermediate term to long-term follow-up in clinical case series on rare problems is difficult to achieve because of small numbers, in general due to disease and patient children. So these are not like arguments that are grounded in research theory. It's more just kind of like, we can't make heads or tails of our data, really. We just want to tell you about what our clinical experience is. And that's fine because, maybe it is a very rare circumstance or an unusual, experience. But what it really comes down to is that, they're reporting as a conclusion, base plate survivorship of 78.4% at intermediate term follow-up of 5 years. It's a truncated population. It's potentially an idealized population because, as we know, oftentimes when you're not seeing patients back or you lose patients, even those who pass away, and maybe they pass away due to other reasons, or maybe there were some that are in some way collinear with problems with the surgery or the implant. These are challenging surgeries, no question. And I have no doubt that this is adding to the literature, but ultimately, even just looking at their limitations alone, I question whether there's a prospect for real clinical application. That's probably my biggest reservation at this point. This is this group's experience over a 10-year time window, and it's unclear that in different hands, the outcomes would be the same.
Well said. Not much to add there, but agree. Nope.
All right, let's get into yours. Your headline, what's new in the joint world this week, primary total knee arthroplasty in patients with BMI greater than or equal to 50 kilograms per meter squared, a cohort study with long-term follow-up by Rigolt, and a pen with a comment, so don't just take it from us.
So arthroplasty surgeons, as you can imagine, have put arbitrary cutoffs for BMI for total joint replacement, specifically total knee replacements and total hip replacements, but this study focuses on total knee prior to surgery. And the number 40 is one that's often floated, although 40 kilograms per meter squared BMI came from a study in 1998 where 2% of patients became infected if their BMI was under 40 and 22% if BMI was greater than 40. So that delineated a pathway. At one point in time, the NHS even said if you were 35 or above, you wouldn't be able to undergo surgery. So it's a very controversial area, but there's plenty of studies that say, well, if you undergo surgery over a 50 BMI, you're totally fine and you have good outcomes. So this study looked at primary total knee arthroplasty patients with a BMI greater than 50 with long-term follow-up of 10 years. And that is unique. Most of the studies look at one-year outcomes or 2 years outcomes, but typically not 10-year outcomes, specifically looking at BMI. So this is a single center study. It's a retrospective study in Canada with 6 arthroplasty surgeons. And they looked at over 10,000 patients. About 7,000 were women, 4,000 were men. And there were 38 unknown. And they compared the outcomes between patients with a BMI of greater than 50 or greater than equal to 50, which was 627 patients, and then patients in other weight classes. So the majority of patients by far were less than 50 kilograms per meter squared. And the definitions they used were the WHO classification of BMI, underweight, normal weight, overweight, and then defined obese 3 as patients with a BMI from 40 to 49.99, and obese 4 as those patients who had a BMI of 50 or greater. And the follow-up was conducted between December 12, 2020 and January 19, 2024. The nice thing about the Canadian system, as you can imagine, is that it is a single-payer system, so they have the ability to have long-term follow-up with these patients. They stated that they were similar implants that were used. The fixation was mostly cemented and the surgical approach was mostly the same. So they didn't really look into that. It seems like most of the implants were, we call, cruciate, not cruciate retaining. They were posterior stabilized. Only a small percentage were cruciate retaining. So they didn't use that as part of the analysis. That said, because these patients are obese, I would have loved to know if tibial stems were used. That is an indication in an obese patient population, especially with regards to survivorship. So that's one area where it comes to implant, not necessarily the femoral component side, but the tibial component side that I would actually really like to know. So a bunch of different PROMs were looked at preoperatively and at 1, 5, and 10 years postoperatively. Satisfaction was measured on a 5-point Likert scale during routine clinical follow-up visits. Pain score was on a 100-point scale, 0 for nerve pain, 100 for max pain, EQ5D for a quality of life metric, and the Oxford Knee score. And please note that the VAS score and the EQ5D were only collected since 2019. So they talk about 10-year follow-up. Obviously, there's not 10-year follow-up for these two parameters because they only started getting collected in 2019. Note that the one-year follow-up ranged between 183 days to 547 days. The follow-up, they said, the average follow-up was 8.6 years. So they said they went up to 10 years postoperatively, but the range for the postoperative PROMs was 8 to 12 years. So patients did go up to 12 years, but the mean, as you saw here, was 8.6 years. So ideally, this study could have been done where they say the minimum was 10 years. The authors used Cox proportional hazard models to estimate the association between BMI and revision risk using overweight patients, and that's defined as BMI 25 to 29.99 kilograms per meter squared as the reference group while adjusting for patient age and sex. So what did the study show? It showed that the proportion of female patients increased and the patient's age decreased with an increasing BMI. Basically, if you had higher BMI, you were typically more likely to be female and tended to be younger. With increasing body mass index, they tended to have lower preoperative PROM scores, and that's a trend, not a significance. Postoperative patient satisfaction was slightly higher in higher BMI patients. Now we're talking 61% versus 65%, but no statistical comparison between the groups. The improvement in the Oxford Knee score was largest in the obese 4 patients, which is the patient population of interest, for whom the median increase was 2 points higher than that for obese 1 patients, up to 10 years postoperatively. The one-year improvement in the pain VAS score was almost negligible for normal weight patients, but was greater than 10 points for more obese patients. Now, please note that the preoperative scores for most obese patients were typically lower than those who were non-obese patients. The one-year change in the EQ5D score was also highest for obese 4 patients, with a median increase of 0.25. Every 1 unit increase in BMI of obese patients led to a 0.7 increase in the Oxford Knee score improvement at the 1 year mark. So it corresponded to a full point of additional Oxford Knee score improvement for 14 kilogram per meter squared of increased BMI. That said, this was only at 1 year. At 5 years and 10 years, the association was not significant for VAS or EQ5D, but please keep note that the VAS and EQ5D wasn't necessarily there because they were only collected since 2019. For revisions, looking at their primary endpoint, there were 315 revisions among all patients. In the obese 4 patients, again, these patients that were looking at the 50 and greater BMI, infection was the most common reason for revision, accounting for 35%, followed by instability or malpositioning, which is 24%. In the first year, revisions were more common for obese 4 patients than for any other weight class, with a hazard ratio of 3.7. But the rates were not markedly increased compared to other weight classes at any time point after 1 year, and they had a hazard ratio of 1.2. There's a similar risk of revision between obese 2 and obese 3 patients. So looking at those parameters, sometimes people looking at 40 as a cutoff is very similar between 30 BMI to 40 BMI and 40 BMI to 50 BMI. So the conclusion that the author stated that they confirmed the increased risk of failure in total knee arthroplasty patients with BMI 50 or greater for the first year after surgery, but not much more after that. And no real difference again, with 35 to 40 or 40 plus to 50. The increase in the revision risk in the greater equal to 50 kilometer per meter squared group was found only in the first postoperative year and plateaued afterwards. Now, interestingly enough, their conclusion said despite worse function and higher failure rates, patients with BMI of greater than or equal to 50 had reported benefits and high satisfaction with total knee arthroplasty. So worse function, not actually a great thing, obviously, or higher failure rates, which is a big deal. So I would like to know implant constructs. Now, that said, they did have good improvement after surgery, but they started so low that their improvement was there, but not necessarily to a high enough point to someone else who didn't have a low preoperative PROMS. Satisfaction is also a really hard marker to use. I understand you're like strongly dissatisfied, neutral, you know, satisfied and very satisfied. Now, maybe the patients were satisfied because no one else would do their surgery. And so the fact that they were willing to do their surgery made them satisfied, even if they didn't have a good outcome. And it's also not necessarily statistically significant at 61% versus 65%. What I'm curious about is any restrictions in Canada based on patient weight. I can take from this center, from this paper, that there were no restrictions. But were there restrictions? You know, were there other parameters that came into play? Like if you had uncontrolled diabetes or if you smoked or all these other things, would that make a difference on what you would do? And finally, there was no data on race or ethnicity, which obviously would be nice to add. So this paper, while interesting, has a few holes in it that I think would concern me by being a take-home message and being like, see, it's okay to do patients' total knee replacements in BMI greater or equal to 50, but do take in mind that the revision rate is higher in that first year.
Yeah, I mean, I think you touched on several points that I was thinking about as well. You know, we talked about in the previous study that it's, you know, when you've been doing it this long, it looks like it's magic. And you know, this is a single center, academic center type study. They may be the center of excellence, so to speak, for patients who are in obese categories that merit total knee replacement. I don't know that for a fact, of course, but if you're doing any kind of specialty procedure, whether it's, you know, revision, hip arthroplasties with severe bone loss or total, putting in total femurs and things like that, it becomes sort of this, you know, there's a selection and an indication, and also that's distilled through the prism of the expertise of the center, so that by definition, their outcomes are, you know, just because they do it and they can do it well doesn't mean that anyone can do it well, and that these outcomes will be the same in some other setting somewhere else in Canada or in the United States. I also feel like they made like a lot of comparisons between and across groups, sometimes talking about the 25 to 29.99 group, BMI group as the referent, but then also talking about like 40 to 49.99 versus 35 to 39.99. And sometimes that's really hard, you know, because you're making comparisons between groups, and especially when you're comparing the 50 to the 25 to 29.99. But what if you compared them to a different referent? What if it was to the less than 24 group, or, you know, 24.99 or under, then how does it look? So, yeah, I mean, I think there's some interesting findings here, but as you said, a lot of questions as well. Let's move on to the Your Cases on Hold featurette. This is effects of depression and or anxiety on the outcomes of hip arthroscopy for femoral acetabular impingement and labral tears, a minimum 5-year follow-up study. seems like we have a lot of minimum 5-year follow-up or long-term follow-up studies on this issue, which is great. This data is a retrospective analysis, also for the years 2008 to 2018, for patients who had undergone arthroscopy for treatment of femoral tear impingement and labral tears. The authors report that they went through their entire cohort and they found patients who had a self-reported history of depression and/or anxiety and match these to a control group of patients that did not have such diagnosis, and a one-to-one ratio on the basis of age at the time of surgery, set body mass index, acetabular, outer bridge grade, labral treatment, and capsular treatment. Yeah. So this study, ultimately, they had 250 patients with minimum 5-year follow-ups, 125 patients with depression and/or anxiety, and they successfully matched these to 125 control patients with no depression or anxiety. So they found matches for all patients. I don't see here that there's an effective description of the caliper. They talk about doing a power analysis, which I guess makes sense in some ways because they're trying to leverage the propensity score component as essentially a causal inference test mimicking a randomized trial, if you were. But in this case, the analogy doesn't exactly hold up because you're sort of randomizing patients indicated for surgery to have depression or anxiety or not. And I'm not sure that really washes, nor are these other factors that they're considering necessarily associated or proven to be associated with depression and anxiety. They're also using p-values to assess post-match balance, which is not the ideal practice. And what they found was that of the 125 HIPs in patients with depression or anxiety, as compared to the 125 controls, there was significant improvement in all functional outcome scores with a magnitude of improvement that was comparable across groups. Depression and anxiety groups started with significantly lower preoperative scores, essentially across the board for all the parameters that were considered. And there was no significant difference between the two groups with regard to secondary procedures and complications. Patients with depression and anxiety also had lower rates of achievement of patient acceptable symptom state. So their conclusion is hip arthroscopy for the treatment of femoral tibial impingement and labral tears in patients with depression and or anxiety resulted in significant intermediate term achievement in functional and health-related quality of life. However, compared with the control group, the functional scores in this patient population started lower and ended lower. In addition, they had a lower rate of achieving the PASS thresholds than those in the control group. So, I mean, that's a conclusion that's essentially stating the study findings. You know, they say the main finding is that patients with depression and or anxiety, and we should stop right there because this is 125 patients. Depression and or anxiety are spectrum disorders. There's obviously low levels of anxiety, depression, and then there's very severe manifestations of those conditions or those conditions together with associated risks. So, I mean, clearly, I think there's prospects of restricted clinical variation across the psychology domain. And probably patients with very severe manifestations of the disorder may not even realistically be indicated for an elective procedure such as this. So we're probably talking about patients with lower levels of manifestations of these conditions by and large. I think the findings are somewhat intuitive, particularly around the fact that, you know, in most studies, patients with low levels of depression or anxiety tend to have reasonable outcomes. And when you're talking about pain perception and things such as kinesiophobia and limitations in that regard, these conditions that sort of have intersections with that may modulate patients' abilities to achieve the highest level. But just because they don't get the same thing that patients with the condition, as the study shows, does not necessarily mean that they have inferior outcomes as compared to their baseline state. I think the research approach is a little bit of what I call Potemkin Village. For those who may not know, Potemkin Village is a historical concept where Grigory Potemkin basically built like fake infrastructure villages in the Ukraine to impress Catherine the Great on a grand tour. So I call this a research Potemkin Village because they're going through a lot of procedural steps that seem somewhat exotic and elegant. We're going to do a propensity score match, and it's going to match the patients with depression and anxiety. But again, this was a one-to-one match for which they matched all patients. And second, the factors that they're including in the match you know, this probably could have been achieved with just doing a standard regression, and you're likely to find the same conclusions and outcomes. So the addition of a propensity score saying, well, this was a causal technique, a causal inference technique, I don't think that that is being leveraged to the point where it's making an effective difference in terms of the quality of the result that you're getting from this work.
Won't be able to change anything there, I agree. So on hold or not on hold?
There's nothing to put on hold, honestly. I mean, I think that the study makes sense and the conclusions are reasonable. Just because you did more than you had to come to a conclusion you could have reached with maybe a simpler search, including more patients, doesn't necessarily mean it has to be on hold.
All right. Why don't you take it home with our honorable mentions?
Yep. So the honorable mentions, complication rates and functional outcomes after total ankle arthroplasty in patients with rheumatoid arthritis. This was a retrospective study of 1,071 primary total ankle arthroplasties performed over a 20-year time window. They say it's the largest single institution study to date, probably a reasonable use of that claim based on the clinical nature of this work. Patients with RA reported poor PRA scores compared with OA and post-traumatic arthritis, but experienced functional outcome improvement from preoperative baseline. Then we have intraoperative direct sonication versus conventional sonication in the diagnosis of periprosthetic joint infection, comparison of diagnostic accuracy and time to positivity of fluid culture. This was by Lee and colleagues with a comment. This was a retrospective study of patients diagnosed with periprosthetic joint infection or aseptic loosening who underwent revision, debridement, antibiotics, and implant retention or resection. And perfume, either sonication method, was used between July 2017 and June 2023. The authors maintained intraoperative direct sonication was more sensitive than conventional sonication for the microbiological diagnosis of PGI and slightly shortened the time to positivity of microorganisms. I think that aligns very well with a lot of studies of this type that we have covered in JBJS over the last year to year and a half. And then we have immediate weight bearing compared with non-weight bearing after operative ankle fracture fixation. Results of the INWN pragmatic randomized multicenter trial by Kujali and colleagues with a comment and visual summary. This is the is postoperative non-weight bearing necessary study, prospective pragmatic randomized trial with participants allocating a 1:1 ratio to one of two parallel groups. They recruited 160 patients between 2019 and June 30th, 2020, 80 patients in each arm. They found that, what they were looking to investigate was whether immediate protective weight bearing was non-weight or versus non-weight bearing following ankle fracture fixation resulted in changes in functional outcomes, complications, and cost utility. They found that immediate protective weight bearing in a walking boot following fracture fixation had superior functional outcomes, greater cost savings, early return to work, and similar complication rates compared with the non-weight bearing cohort. You don't have to take it from me. Definitely check those articles out. We have essentially run out of time at this point. Hopefully you like what you heard. Like, subscribe, hit the notification bell. Find us on Castor, Stitcher, Apple, Spotify, Amazon Podcasts, wherever you get your podcasts, or if you can't, at jjjs.org. Spread the word and get others listening. Come back in 2 weeks. Hear what Dr. Chen has to say when she's leading the discussion. And hopefully your summer cases are always on green and ready to go. But if you're here with us, you know that it's pretty much always your case is